And welcome to Weather and Ag and Focus on this finally Friday. It's Pi Day. Austin, or just, geez, Addison, sorry. Do you know what Pi Day is?
I don't even know my name anymore. Who am I now?
I'm losing it, man.
I know, then that's coming from Bonnie over here.
Yeah. Do you guys know what Pi Day is?
No, it sounds delicious.
Yes.
Okay, Bridget knows. So, pi, 3.14. Math.
What are you, my middle school math teacher? Yeah. What is this? What is this, Dean?
Today's National Pi Day. Not the food.
Honestly,
pie.
Where's the weather in agriculture?
Yeah. I will take a rhubarb pie over that 3.14 that still gives me PTSD about high school math.
Right?
I wasn't there for that.
Y equals MX plus B?
See, there. See, you remember Who? Something.
I wouldn't, well.
What's that name?
Yeah. I don't think Bridget, did Bridget hear you?
It doesn't matter anymore.
I did.
Okay, all right.
I did. Right. No, I did, but I was making fun of the fact that I don't even know what that is.
I don't either anymore. I'm going to be honest. I just remember it.
Well, welcome to Weather and Ag and Focus. It's not a math show, but it's we're looking at a beautiful day out there today with near record warmth. I'm Chief Meteorologist Dean Wysocki, along with our Ag Director, Bridget Riedel. What a day out there, Bridget. Holy cow. Too bad it can't stay like this through the weekend.
Well, it's March. It won't.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, we do have a storm system heading our way. I'm sure most everybody's heard all about it. And we've got some good news with this storm. Not good news in terms of moisture, but we've got good terms in terms of the impact that it's going to have across parts of the area. Now, I'm not saying we're not going to get impacted by it. We are. And it's going to be a big storm. With severe weather on one side and near blizzard conditions in parts of the area on the backside. But it looks like the valley so far is going to escape the worst part of this storm as the heavier snow falls off to our east. So we're looking at a beautiful day. Let's focus on today. Get out and enjoy it. Temperatures currently in the mid-60s on our way up close to 70. Record is 68. I think we'll be able to at least tie that. As we have winds out of the southeast, about 10 to 20. Tonight, that's when things start to change. We'll see rain spreading in from the south as we head towards, let's say about 8 o'clock or so. Now, there's a few showers on radar right now out from about Jamestown up into the far northwestern valley. But other than that, more rain comes in from the south as we head after about 8 o'clock. And could see an embedded rumble of thunder. Best shot is going to be south of the FM area in the far southern valley. And then that will mix with a little bit of freezing rain, sleet, as we head towards about 2 in the morning or so. And then as we head towards sunrise, we'll change that over to snow, and winds will be increasing throughout the night at about 30 to 40. And by tomorrow morning, we're looking at north winds at about 30 to 50 miles an hour with any precip changing over to snow here in the valley. And then that will move into Lakes Country by early to mid-morning. Now, if you have travel plans up and down the valley or westward, it's going to be a little tricky in the valley. As you go west, I think conditions will rapidly improve. I would not recommend travel tomorrow going east into Lakes Country until evening when conditions will improve. We will see the winds continue most of the day, and snowfall totals now for the valley look to be about an inch or so. I'm leaning more towards about 1 inch. Some spots could pick up a touch more. But as you get into Lakes Country, we're looking at about 3 to 6 inches of snow, and you factor in those 30 to 40, 50-mile-an-hour winds, that's where the really tough traveling conditions are going to be, is to the east of the valley tomorrow. We were thinking parts of the valley might see 3 to 6 and higher amounts out into Lakes Country, but that's really started to taper back. And part of it is, A, it's a quick-moving system, and B, a lot of times when you get severe weather on the front side of some of these dynamic systems, when you get that severe weather, that robs the moisture from moving further north and wrapping around the backside on the cold side of the system. So with a pretty decent severe weather outbreak expected today from Iowa, Illinois, down into Missouri, that's going to rob a lot of that moisture from getting pulled all the way northward into our area. So Bad news if you need the moisture, but the good news, or let me just say better news, not good news, but better news if you have any travel tomorrow. But again, I would not recommend traveling east of the valley until tomorrow evening when conditions start to improve a little bit.
Well, I think most everybody is hearing that well in advance and making some plans for it. But also, I think right now, if we're going to get moisture, this is a personal thought. We're probably not going to get that much out of this. So I'd almost hope that that snow does move further east. I don't need the rain and the wet to make everything muddy if it's just going to be a little bit on the surface. Let's let that stuff slide through to the east and let's let where things dry out. Mm-hmm. Let the frost come out of the ground. Let calving finish. And then once we get later on into April, then let's get rain.
Right.
Let's get some planting accomplished. Mm-hmm. Let's get some rain. Let's really recharge our soils then. There may be some folks that argue with me, and if you want to, you sure can. You can send me emails, ag@flagfamily.com, or let us know what you're thinking about what you want for rainfall in your region. And you can do that on the JLA insurance phone line. You can reach us at 701-293-9000. Thanks to Nate Thorsrud from JLA Insurance for sponsoring our phone line.
All right.
Sounds like we have a caller as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, we got Paul on line one. Paul, what you got for us this afternoon?
Hey, well, I see they put chemicals on the interstate already, so maybe they're getting ready for something coming, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're just playing it safe. I'm not saying we're going to escape this in the FM area. Up and down the 29 corridor, we are expecting some wintry precip as we head into the overnight hours, but we're not expecting as much as we were originally thinking, but it's going to be slippery around here by tomorrow morning. Don't get me wrong.
We're not going to get no snow, Harley. Are we going to have blowing dirt again? I know she said she doesn't want any snow, but does she want blowing dirt too or what?
Yeah, that's that's a good point, Paul. We probably will, especially west of the valley. There's high wind watches out to the west of the valley currently, and with those 30 to 50 mile an hour winds and no snow on the ground out west, we are going to be dealing with that, unfortunately, it looks like. I don't think we're going to be dealing with as much of that in the FM area. Up in the valley, but west of the valley, yeah, I do see that happening.
Well, and I think too that
when these storms come, some winters you get these storms coming big like this one, and all of a sudden, you know, it covers most of North Dakota, most of Minnesota, and this one is just doing nothing.
Yeah, it's the way the system is tracking. It's no specific rhyme or reason, but again, if you follow along with the LRC, we're on about a 40 to 42 day cycle, centered at right around 41 days. So this same system will be back in our area. Right around that third week in April, and typically by then these systems move a little further northwest of like the current track. Not saying we can't get snow out of it, but watch for this same system. And this was the big moisture maker that we had in November. Unfortunately, this time around, it's not giving us the moisture. It's giving it into lakes country. And again, a lot of that has to do with in November, we didn't have a big severe weather outbreak with it, so that moisture was able to be pulled up northward and wrapped around into the system, where this time it's not able to do that. So as we head into this storm, when it comes by in April, late April, hopefully we don't have a severe weather outbreak and we can just get some good plentiful moisture, which would be good timing in late April.
Well, I put my rain gauge off, so we'll see how much rain we get.
There you go. Hey, Paul, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. And that's a good point. Yeah. You know, they are treating the interstates, and better safe than sorry. I'm not saying we're going to get missed totally by this, but we're going to miss out on what we could have had a bigger pain in the butt, I guess you could say, for travel.
Well, and I think that, you know, nobody wants blowing snow, dirt, or snert out there.
Right.
And so Paul's right. But if we're only going to get a tiny bit of rain, that's only going to make things muddy on that top half inch of soil, and then it's all going to blow, that's not going to be a fix.
Yeah.
So we need something more significant, I'm afraid.
Yeah. In terms of moisture in the valley, I'm seeing a quarter inch or less. Now, as you get into lakes country, we're looking at about a half inch to three quarters of an inch of precips. So much better news for Lakes Country, but not so much up and down the valley and points westward.
Yeah, it's going to be quite a changing situation out there. So what we basically said is if you're east of the Fargo-Moorhead area, plan for Snowmageddon. If you're further west, hold on to your hat. It's going to be pretty nuts out there for a while.
Yeah, it's going to be windy across all of the area tomorrow. So, again, travel plans in the morning, not recommended. Wait till the afternoon or evening, especially evening when conditions will improve. We'll see the sun come out by tomorrow afternoon here in the valley and points westward. So
we'll likely see ice overnight. And before that, though, I would imagine, right now.
Yeah.
Things are going to freeze.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt about it. Well, we got a special guest coming on the show today, Bridget.
Of course, we are going to get an opportunity to visit I have to make sure I say Bruce's last name right. Bruce Joving. And Bruce is from Grand Forks. He is a great benefactor to the area because he's an author of three different books. And I've got one right here. We're talking about innovative entrepreneurs and especially three different entrepreneurs that have had a lot to do with agriculture in North Dakota. I've got to grab my other book off the shelf that has these three specific folks in it. Some of the folks that we want to talk about today that Paul has written stories of. I hope we can get to everybody. We are going to visit about Earl Babcock, David Houston, who actually lived in this area where I live and was part of Kodak Film, and then Andrew Johnston. He really set in motion the wheels of what became branding in North Dakota, as well as the North Coast Stockmen's Association. He was a rancher out by Watford City. So we're going to hear those historical stories when we return. Stay tuned. Thanks to American Ag Network for the Market Report. Much appreciated. And also, I'm excited to visit with one of my favorite authors. I love local authors. You can always send me suggestions. And someone that I not only ran across, but then also had the fortuitousness to meet in person is Bruce Govig. And Bruce is a lifelong North Dakotan. He has written three books. I have two of them right here. I believe the third one I've loaned out, and I don't remember who's got them. So if somebody has my books, tell me. he's written about innovative entrepreneurs in the Dakotas, primarily North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota. And they are such a wealth of knowledge. And Bruce, you and I said we're going to try to talk about three different people today. And let's see if we can get through them. So, okay. Earl Babcock, tell us about Earl.
Okay, well, Earl Babcock grew up in Minnesota, and he's a graduate of the University of Minnesota in 1889, same year that we became the state. And then he joined the University of North Dakota as a chemistry professor. So our university was only 6 years old. It was a brand new state, 1 year old. He comes out here. And within the very first thing, he starts doing, as a chemistry professor, field studies to prove the viability of sugar beets. Now, why? And first of all, you know that the bonanza farmers out here and the homesteaders were doing heavily growing wheat. And matter of fact, if anything, they were depleting the soil because year after year they were raising hard red spring wheat to sell to the millers in Minneapolis. And we needed to diversify the crops out here. So he started looking at the viability of sugar beets and basically proved that they were very viable, that he got up to 20% sugar. So it was very suitable. And he did those field trials for up to 15 years with various farmers in the area. And matter of fact, when I was doing this research, I found a Herald editorial, an article, where he stated that farmers could generate more money on 5 to 10 acres of sugar beets than 100 acres of wheat. And yet, you know, if we went all the way from the 1890s, the first sugar beet plant in the Red River Valley was 1926 in East Grand Forks. So you think about that's a long time, right, to be doing that. But then Babcock also became Dean of Engineering, School of Engineering and Mines at UND. And if you remember at that place, UND was a professional school and NDSU, then North Dakota Agricultural College, they also had an engineering program there, as all did land-grant colleges. They were the ag engineering state, and we become the energy engineering state, or college university for the state. And so he also worked on lignite and different uses and clays. Matter of fact, he's one that really developed the clays for pottery, tableware, sewer pipe, drain tile, all that kind of stuff. But he just kept working with those farmers, and in 1920, there were 34 growers of sugar beets around Grand Forks and East Grand Forks. And they, at that time, they were getting 7.7 tons per acre with over 17% sugar. And they were sending them to southern Minnesota for processing. So it was finally in 1923 that the Grand Forks Chamber of Commerce sold $300 worth of stock. And to give that a sense, that's about $4.5 million today. And they also signed up for a $100,000 loan. So that's, you know, $1.5 million loan today to construct the plant. So they finally found a closed sugar beet plant in California, which they assembled in East Grand Forks, and got it built for $1.2 million. And I tried to find out where the rest of the money come from, and I never did. And it took 500 workers at that time to run that plant. So we finally got our first sugar beet plant 30 years later. And Earl Babcock died in 1925 when the plant was under construction. So he never got to see it operational, but he did see his dream of a sugar beet plant, a facility, a factory, realized in 1925 it was under construction, and it opened up in 1926. And if you remember then, in the sugar beet plants, I had to look it up for this program. 1948 is when the Moorhead plant was open. 1954, it was Crookston. 1965, Drayton. And in 1971, the farmers formed a co-op because the American Crystal Sugar, based out of Denver, was run in a family foundation and, quite frankly, was very poorly managed. They were really worried about its future. They had closed many of their plants. And finally, this sugar cooperative bought American Crystal for $86 million in 1973, and it was the first sugar cooperative in the nation. And then they built the Hillsboro plant. So that's sort of the history how a chemistry professor, then engineering professor from UND, brought the sugar beet industry to the Red River Valley.
He was literally a one-man band to bring sugar beets to the valley. And you're right, that was the tail end of the bonanza farms. Things were trailing off as far as soil fertility, and they were losing yield. What a wonderful diversification. And I'm sad to hear that he didn't live long enough to actually see the plants built and more work being done here in the valley.
Yeah, he died at his, he had a summer cabin at Lake Bemidji in Minnesota. He was 60 years old, went out for a swim in the morning, and they found him dead of an apparent heart attack when he was swimming. So 60 years old. So very unfortunate. I think it's very sad he did not get to see that, yeah, in full bloom.
Yeah. Bruce, when you're researching for all of these stories, you know the facts and the figures. You know that it was $1.5 million to construct the plant at East Grand Forks. They spent $1.3 million. There were other dollars involved. Where do you find all the information?
Well, luckily, there's a lot of news stories. You can go into that. That's where the newspaper is very valuable. And there are some folks who have written the history of some of this. So you get some of it through, well, it takes many sources is the bottom line. But luckily, the newspaper is always a rich source. But you also know that sometimes they don't get all their facts right. So you look for another place to collaborate that if you can. But sometimes you don't know if they are just repeating what they said, read in the newspapers. So there's this, it's the same misinformation twice, or if it's confirmation. But then the folks who did write the history of American Crystal, well, were really very good. And I sort of really believe their facts as well. So it's many sources.
One of the things you mentioned about Earl was he did a lot of work with clay tile, pottery. Did he have something to do with, is it called the Rosemaid or the Rosemead pottery that's from this region as well?
Yes, he did. And, the most famous one that comes out of UND, all of a sudden I forgot the name of it.
I can't remember
it's
either.
It's got the school of mines, stamp on it. But Rosemead is also another one of the branches. Yes, he did. He brought a young professor out of Minnesota to come up here and to do these clays and really develop the pottery. And the pottery became very famous. And, and also that resulted, by the way, his work in the Hebron brick plant out in Hebron, North Dakota.
Oh, so really? He literally spawned that as well.
Yes, absolutely. And as well, his lignite research really ended up, with the lignite plant, activities at the University of North Dakota, which ended up laying the groundwork for EERC. So although he's not the founder of EERC, He was really a founder of the Lignet Research that led to the EERC at UND. So, I mean, he really left. You think one man leaving, one engineering professor and a dean left one heck of an impact on North Dakota.
He absolutely did. And there's more guys to come, because when we return after our bottom of the hour news, Bruce has other folks we want to highlight today. Again, David Houston, as well as Andrew Johnston, and he was from the Watford City area of North Dakota. I can't wait to visit about these guys as well. Today is a fabulous North Dakota entrepreneur history lesson, and we'll return in just a moment. Welcome to Weather and Ag and Focus in today's agricultural history education. We are joined by Bruce Govig. Bruce is a lifelong North Dakotan who writes fantastic books that are summarizations of the life and times of innovative entrepreneurs in North Dakota. Now, whenever I pick up Bruce's books, I always, oops, gotta go this way so we can see him on the camera. I always focus on those who are farm related. And I happen to live in the neighborhood where one of his interviewees, perhaps, was living at a certain time in history. And that was David Houston from the Hunter, North Dakota area. So, Bruce, I have some local stories about David, but would you care to give a synopsis about him yourself?
Although David Houston was a very successful farmer, he came to Hunter, North Dakota it was 1878. So it was Dakota Territory, and he purchased 1878-79, and he purchased, 400 acres of land. So he didn't homestead, but, and the Bonanza farmers, obviously, they came in a few years earlier. So, and I don't know what the attraction was. That I don't know, and if you have that, I would be very interested. But what he did is really made his name is having patents in photography. And he spent his whole life with over 20 patents in the photography area, which he sold nearly all of them to the Eastman Company, and starting when he was in North Dakota. So in his first major invention was in 1881, which was the roll film holder, which he anticipated rolling film. So he invented something before the film was invented. And that was a very interesting thing about it. Flexible film was invented 3 years later, right? Which made handheld cameras practical. And so he sold that patent in 1884. So he did it in 1881, got it, didn't sell it till the flexible film was ever there in 1884. Sold it to the Eastman Company for $700. And then he just did a whole bunch of improvements onto the cameras, for Eastman. And in 1888, he recommended the name Kodak, for then, which the company accepted, as then it became Eastman Kodak. And the name Kodak, of course, is associated with cameras worldwide. And it is believed, and also the source of this is his niece, is that the Kodak is a derivation of Nodak. And this is 1888. So a lot of people think Nodak is short for North Dakota, but it's actually in 1888 was short for Northern Dakota Territory. We didn't become a state until 1889. So the Kodak and Nodak is very interesting. But between 1881 and 1902, in that 20 years, he did 21 patents for camera parts, which he all sold to Kodak. There was only one time that he sold an invention to another camera, and he sold it to the American Camera Company, and that was for a front-mounted roll holder. And Eastman, the minute he found out about it, purchased the company. So all of his patents ended up with Eastman Kodak Company. And he died in 1906, and at that time he was farming 4,000 acres. And to give you a sense of that, there was 92 Bonanza farmers in North Dakota. And 4,000 acres was towards the low end of Bonanza farmers. Some of the Bonanza farmers had 4,000 or 5,000 acres, and the largest, of course, was Dalrymple, who farmed 100,000 acres. So he had managed to go from 400 acres to 4,000 acres in 20 years. And I really don't know as much about that farm story as I'd like, and maybe you can fill in some gaps there.
Well, there's a few things I know. People around this region still know where the Houston farm was, and are able to talk about some of that land that's exchanged hands over the years. As far as his farming story, I don't know exactly how he did all that, but from what I've read, as well as what you've highlighted, He also had a hand in working on new wheat varieties and improving a disc plow. And yeah, that certainly had to help generate his profitability for land purchases, I would imagine, correct?
Right, exactly. I mean, certainly he was selling, he was getting good money for his patents, right? I think the highest one I found was $5,000, which would be $150,000 today. So, I mean, you know, that was certainly, it would help his farming operation as well, right? Giving him cash, and even in a bad year. But he was all very inventive elsewhere, which is your point, with wheat varieties and with farm equipment. He was a very active farmer. I just didn't, I was more interested in the camera story, so I didn't pay as much attention to his farm. But 4,000 acres in, you know, 1900 and, you know, 1880s, that's a big farm. That's a significant operation.
Yeah. It really is. To a testament to his family, I'm not sure if it's a sightseeing attraction or not, but David Houston's buried here in the Hunter City Cemetery, and it's really a very statuesque memorial to him and his family. Yes. Additionally, the story is told. Oh, go ahead, Bruce, go ahead.
Well, his home is also in Bonanzaville, I was going to add. So, you know, I have not visited his grave. You just told me, when I drive by Hunter, sometime I, which cemetery is it in, Bridget?
The only cemetery we have, and it's on the northwest part of town. So it's the only one.
Okay, so it is the one right outside of town then.
Now, about his house. Because you mentioned his house is at Bonanzaville, and he was also instrumental in the newspaper of the era called the Hunter Times, and that building's at Bonanzaville too. Now, I'm still new in town. I've only lived in Hunter just over 20 years, but I'm told that's only half of David Houston's house at Bonanzaville. The house was cut in half. Half went to Bonanzaville, half stayed on the farmstead out here at Hunter. And that home is now gone that stayed out on the farmstead. In fact, one of our salesmen here at WDAY, his dad would tell the story that great-great-grandma and grandpa met at the Houston house. She was a house girl, was one of the maids. Grandpa was a farmhand. And so that's how they met, was compliments of David Houston. So the legend lives on.
I did not know about it. The house, it wasn't in the entire house. I knew they had a huge house because there was many newspaper reports about the size of his house and the fact that they had staff. They, you know, they had staff helping him with the house.
It's a pretty neat story. And we're going to move to another pretty neat story, if you will. And someone else who just emphasizes the high concentration of entrepreneurs and inventors from North Dakota, Northwest Minnesota. And that's Andrew Johnston with the Triple V Ranch out near Watford City. So once again, Bruce, you've got a great synopsis for Andrew.
Yeah. Well, he was born in 1885 in Dakota Territory near Taylor, North Dakota, you know, on the way to Dickinson, if you've been down that road. And his dad was a rancher. And by age 10, he was already in charge of 400 cattle. Oops, sorry about that.
That's okay. You'll just call them back later, Bruce. Don't worry. Yep, they may be calling to tell you you're doing a great job.
And at age 14, he had his own brand, the Triple V Ranch, which you said, that's the brand he kept for the rest of his life. But he had it by age 14, and he had his own cattle. And when he was 21 years of age, in 1906, he moved to Watford City, and he homesteaded on the Wild Cow Creek, which is north of Watford City. Don't you love that name? You know, Wild Cow Creek.
Yes.
But in 1914, he bought a Model T Ford pickup. And when he was going using it on the farm, when he had to get out to open and shut the gates, quite often the brakes on that Ford did not hold up on some of the hills. So in his frustration, what he did is he dug out a ditch before the gate, and he put in small logs to hold the vehicle and the brakes. And what he observed is that the cattle would not walk on those small logs. And then, you know, and so he was solving a problem, right? You know, he didn't want the poor pickup to get away from him on a hill as it's opening and closing gates. But it worked. So he saw that these small logs, these saplings, that just keep the car safe, that the cattle wouldn't do it. So that became the very first cattle guard. That's how he invented cattle guards and used that all over the place. And it really, you know, caught on from there, you know, is these cattle guards of using, because the cattle wouldn't walk in anything that was unstable, loose footing. So, you know, that's sort of interesting. He also then went on to do, he built a elevator on the hill, and he dumped the wheat and barley and stuff at the top of the hill and unloaded the bottom. So it was the first one of the first gravity feed elevators. But, you know, where he has a lasting legacy besides the cattle guard is in 1928, he organized 18 other ranchers to establish a reward fund to discourage cattle rusting, and $1,000 reward for catching a cattle thief, which is about $15,000 today. But that led to the next year, 1929, to forming the North Dakota Stockmen's Association. And he served as the first secretary treasurer and then president. And he was instrumental in starting brand inspections and keeping brand records in both North Dakota and South Dakota. And he was a member of the American National Cattlemen's Association for 55 years, attending 52 of the conventions. The fact that, you know, it's hard to think of it now, we just take it for granted, right? But you know, there's brand records and they're keeping it. And the Stockmen's Association plays a very valuable role in that industry. But, you know, it's all about, you know, solving the problem of cattle rustling, right? That's how all that happened. So here he is, a guy that is finding solutions to problems. And unfortunately, the 1930s hit Watford City area and most of Western very hard. And so at his peak, he had 1,300 Hereford cattle, 400 draft horses, and 100 horses. Now, that's quite an enterprise.
And yes, it is.
He wrote the history of the cowboys of Western North Dakota, two volumes, 50 Years in the Saddle, 1 and 2. So if anyone's interested in doing that, but he ended up capturing the history of the cowboy era in Western North Dakota. He died in 1970 at age 85. So as you see, and what's common in all these innovations is they're solving real problems and making a real difference, right? I mean, a cattle guard is, you know, just for the power of observation, right? Cattle wouldn't walk on these. He's trying to stop his Ford pickup from rolling, and he solves the problem of, you know, cattle, you know, going through a fence. It's really very interesting.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And in a way, you kind of answered my question, because when I look at your volumes of work, I think that we have a tremendous concentration of entrepreneurs in this region. Or maybe it's just the fact that I'm aware of them. But do you feel like we have more folks up here who've been inventive over the years to try to bring those solutions, maybe because we were fairly remote versus other areas of the country?
I think you nailed it right there, Bridget. It is. People in more rural, remote areas have to solve their own problems. You can't just go to town and ask people, you know, what can you do about this? I mean, you got to figure it out yourself. And these people are, I am convinced that we have a lot more innovation and entrepreneurship than a lot of other places, just for that fact. People have got to find their own solutions to their problems, and people going, you know, there must be a better way. And people will find that better way and have found that better way.
I love listening to the story.
I think it's all people with a, you know, keen observation, right? I mean, to observe the cattle wouldn't walk over small logs or saplings, you know, and what does that mean, right? I mean, I think some people can take a look at it and see nothing, right? And other people go, oh, here's a solution that I can use all over the place. You know, so it's very interesting.
And Bruce, anybody that's been...
branding, right? If we organize, we get all the other stockmen organized, and we can find these cattle thieves. You know, by the way, just unrelated to this, and it's a Texas story, you know where the term maverick comes from. There was an attorney named Maverick in Texas that didn't want to hurt his cows. And so, quote unquote, that's his story. So he never branded his cows. So when he was out there in the ranch country, he then collected any cows that didn't have a brand on them as his. And that's where the term maverick comes from, you know, is unbranded cattle, you know, open in the range. You know, but it's all because an attorney had thought it was very clever by not having a brand. He got to collect the cows that they weren't yet branded.
Interesting. Wow.
It is interesting.
Wow. Right? Hey, Bruce, if anybody wants to find your books, after, you know, they're listening today and thinking, wow, you know, this is, I want to read up more on this. Where can they find some of your books at?
Well, they can find them in the bookstores, whether it's at, you know, the Heritage Center in Bismarck or the Ferguson bookstores. But you can also order them online at dakotabooknet.com, dakotabooknet.com.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. It's now. How about, like, do you ever go out and give lectures at all about your vast knowledge of the entrepreneurship?
I did a lot of it when the books were new. I'm doing less of it right now as the books have matured a little bit.
Okay.
You know, because my last book was done in 23 and my first one in 2019 on this series of three. But I'm certainly more than willing to, because it is, I really believe that one of the reasons I did these books is I wanted to collect this history before it was lost. And I really do, because I think it's a very interesting history of, you know, North Dakotans don't necessarily see themselves as innovative and entrepreneurial, but I mm-hmm. think they very much are. Do they think of themselves as practical? I would say yes. So I think if most people, you know, and do they think of themselves as having common sense and solving problems? You'd say yes. But interesting how that doesn't necessarily translate into innovative and entrepreneurial.
Oh, you've proven that they are both innovative and entrepreneur. And Bruce, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate it. And I hope you just enjoy this weekend before the snow comes.
Well, yes, and I appreciated your observation that we don't want snert, so maybe a little bit of rain to keep the snert down is good. But, you know, ice under snow is never good in high wind. So we need some moisture, no question. We need moisture.
No doubt. Well, Bruce, thanks so much. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll recap the weather. There's been an update on some of our advisories and warnings. I'll tell you more about those coming up right after the break. And welcome back to Weather and Ag in Focus. Want to thank you for joining us on this finally Friday. It's 1:55 in the afternoon. Want to give you a quick update on the weather, because a big storm is going to be pulling out of the Central Plains into the Northern Plains, and it will affect our area, not as harsh as we thought before, but it looks like we will get some precip. We're still technically under a winter storm watch for most of the area. Now, they just upgraded this to a blizzard warning in the Sisseton area, and I'm guessing that will be extended northeastward through Lakes Country. That's where the worst conditions are going to be. So traveling south or east of the FM area tomorrow, not recommended until probably late in the day. I do believe we'll probably be put under some type of advisory here in the FM area, as they'll upgrade that to blizzard warnings off to our east. Just taking a look at our latest computer guidance that just came in, and it is indicating that we're looking at a really, really messy situation up and down the valley into Lakes Country between 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. That's when the icy and snowy conditions are really going to encompass much of the valley, and especially into Lakes Country, while heavy snow goes down to our south, down towards the Sisseton area. Now, that will slowly move eastward throughout the day. We'll see sunshine by late in the day, but the key time frame of this storm system for the valley is going to be between about 5 o'clock in the morning and 10 o'clock in the morning tomorrow, where we'll have 30 to 50 mile an hour winds, a mix of snow and sleet and freezing rain changing over to all snow. Snow will be heavier in Lakes Country. I'm thinking about an inch, maybe two here in the FM area, so not a lot of snow, but it doesn't take a lot when you've got 30 to 50 mile an hour winds whipping out of the north. Higher snowfall totals in Lakes Country, where I'm sure, again, I'm guessing blizzard warnings are going to be issued by the National Weather Service. So travel south and east of the FM area tomorrow, not a good idea. If you're going west, much better, but it's still going to be on the windy side, and again, could see some blowing dust and dirt out to our west as well. So although we're not going to get as much snow as anticipated, even an inch or two, Bridget, is going to play a big problem if you're going doing any travel tomorrow, especially in the morning. But wait till late in the day. Conditions will definitely improve.
Well, we'll wait to see how things happen. But again, always be prepared. Stay tuned to the radio so everybody knows what might be coming at them. Speaking of things that are going to be coming at you, if you are a farmer or a rancher, and you can nominate others as well, the applications are currently open for the Leopold Conservation Award. excuse me, those are due April 15th. There is a $10,000 prize that can be presented to those who are the winners, and it's for conservation work in the state.
All right. Well, that's about it. Bridget's getting all choked up just because it's Friday, I think. But that'll do it for us today on Weather and Ag in Focus. I want to thank everybody for joining us again. Keep up to date on our forecast. We'll be updating this throughout the afternoon, WDAYRadioNow.com. But again, if you have any travel plans tomorrow morning, that's when things are going to be a little bit tricky around the valley and into Lakes Country. So for Bridget, myself, I want to thank everybody for joining us. Have a great weekend. The Jay Thomas Show, it's coming up next.